Muchas gracias, Javier. Buenas tardes. It is for me a great pleasure and a privilege to be here to speak to you, give the opening keynote at the Second Congress on Labor, Economy, and Society. It's an occasion that reminds us all that it is trade unions who do the hard work of defending democracy, and in fact of constructing democracy in the first place. Just a few minutes ago, upstairs, your Secretary General gave me this plaque, which you recognize. It's a mold taken from a photograph of the release of the political prisoners at the end of the regime of Francisco Franco. It reminded me of one of my most precious possessions, which I inherited from my father, which is a book. It's a copy of his book, The Affluent Society, in Greek. And it was bound very carefully and beautifully in matchsticks, in used matchsticks by three professors who were imprisoned in 1971 by the military junta in Greece. So that's just to say that even occasionally college professors also play a role in these struggles. This has been a year, it is a year, of some small political miracles and some great political battles. In January, again in Greece, a people who had been battered and beleaguered by 5 years of catastrophically failed austerity policies imposed in 2010, placed a very brave bet on Alexis Tsipras, on my friend Yanis Varoufakis, and on a party that had never before held power in that country. And what was that party? It was a coalition. It was a coalition very strongly formed from trade union activists, along with local militants, young ecologists, and a few college professors. In this fall, in September, I think, to the great consternation of the global financial press, the member voters of another great trade union party, the British Labour Party, decisively repudiated the failed traditions of neoliberal austerity associated with their recent past, and placed a brave bet on a new leader. This was again a sign that in another important country, ordinary people were making a considered judgment that things have to change. And the day before yesterday, the voters of Canada overthrew 10 years of neoliberal austerity and restated their faith and their confidence in the political party that in the past century was responsible for creating a very successful and stable Canadian welfare state. It's also the party from which my own family comes. My grandfather was a relatively minor rural political leader in the Canadian Liberal Party. So I'm particularly proud of the country of my ancestors. Makes an important and progressive political statement. Nor are these events in any sense new. They build on events which are happening elsewhere in the world. They follow, perhaps without in some cases being entirely aware of it, intellectual and political upheavals in recent years in the Spanish-speaking world, especially. The transformations that returned democracy and social progress to many countries in South America. And brought that comment, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Uruguay, Ecuador, Peru, some more difficulties, Venezuela, a measure of broad-based prosperity that had not been seen for a generation. In all of these places, there was a popular movement and the rise of a new economic thinking. Well, a new economic thinking, but a new economic thinking with very well-established roots and traditions. That is to say, a thinking rooted in the historical experience and successful traditions of the 20th century, including in my own country that of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, and enriched, toughened, if you like, in their own experience by a harsh, in many cases brutal, history and the political material that comes from having to live through it. We should remember, of course, that Chile, Argentina, and Brazil were the original laboratories of the neoliberal project. It was there that the ideas that came out of, in some cases, economics departments in the United States got their first trial under the conditions that they otherwise would not have had access to, namely the complete suppression of democratic institutions. Now, by way of ideas, of what does this growing worldwide movement consist? In the first place, or I should say perhaps by way of preliminary, it consists in a well-considered, entirely sensible, experience-based rejection of imposed doctrine. Doctrines that were framed by, I have to say, professional economists, who once, 50, 60, 70 years ago, were a small and disregarded fringe of the economics profession, but who, in my professional lifetime, late 1970s onward, seized control of the economics discipline, of its leading universities, and became the authors of commanding dogmas to which they insisted there were no alternatives. The doctrine was a single line of thought, la pensée unique, or, as it became known after Washington, consensus. It was imposed on all countries, a regime of fiscal austerity, that means rules for, in the first case, the limitation of budget deficits, and then later, as you know, the demand for strictly balanced budgets. In monetary matters, the doctrine has its origins in the gold standard and attempts to create under more, let's say, institutional conditions, managed, or not managed conditions, but bureaucratically imposed conditions, the modern monetary equivalent of the gold standard. And then it amounts an assault on the welfare state, the regulatory state, and social institutions, insisting on deregulation in all spheres, but especially the labor market, the financial market, the privatization of public assets, amounts to the selling off of the common property, and associated creation of private monopolies, to which from which consumers have extraordinary difficulties in escaping. This is all covered by the phrase structural reform, with the idea that these changes would somehow unlock imprisoned forces of productivity growth. But of course, any economist whose experience is rooted in reality, going all the way back to Adam Smith, an icon for conservatives, but in fact a very sensible man, will tell you that the creation of private monopolies is one of the oldest games played by public power, and it has nothing to do with productivity growth or the creation of a common wealth or more efficient functioning market, and everything to do with the distribution of rents and the control over productive assets. So the doctrine was destined to fail. I was a young congressional staffer in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan came in, and for that matter, in the late 1970s when Margaret Thatcher came in. And it was clear then that the enthusiasm behind these doctrines was entirely artificial, and that they would generate a disaster for working people and without creating the kind of new wealth or sustained growth that their advocates, which basically is a matter of propaganda, maintained. But it was clear in the world, as a matter of experience, that this was a failure with the crises of 1997 in Asia, 1998 in Russia, and to all sensible people in the United States and Europe, with the great financial crisis that hit us all in 2007 to 2009, beginning with the disastrous aftermath of the deregulation and desupervision of American financial markets, and continuing to the general crisis of finance in the periphery, what is sometimes called the peripheral states of Europe. In Europe, though, especially, these ideas were written in to, let's say, constitutional stone, into the institutions of the European Central Bank and the fiscal rules of the Maastricht that were imposed around the Maastricht Treaty. And so the struggle to change them is the struggle of the stonemason rather than that of the poet alone. This creates conditions which simply make the task more challenging, but not less necessary. And what then are the new ideas with which these old and failed dogmas must now be replaced? Philosophically, they are the opposite of there is no alternative, of la pensée unique. They forsake the dogmatic for the practical, and the singular for the plural. It is not one alternative, but the idea that there should be the possibility of many choices, each adapted to the conditions and opportunities of particular people. That's the alternative. The alternative is one of pluralism. No one sensible would replace neoliberal rules with romantic revolutionary rhetoric. No one sensible would replace it with another dogmatic economic model, the quasi-neoclassical neo-Keynesian model, which simply says all you need to do is pump up demand in order to make everything work. Stimulus alone is not a sufficient answer. We live in a more complicated and difficult world, and a pragmatic economics, which is being discovered in many places around the world today, must have multiple lines which work together. What should these include? They include certainly an investment strategy, some vision of the particular direction best taken by each society, depending upon its resources, its conditions, and its place in the world of trade and finance. A human strategy, in the first instance for education and training, but also, and very importantly, for jobs, for employment, adapted to social needs, a strategy for wages, and a strategy for an increasing degree, stable degree of equality. Xavier said, I have been for 20 years engaged in a very detached study of economic inequality, one which is really based on improving the information available so that one can make a reasonable analysis of what's been happening in the world. But that study does lead us to some reasonable conclusions. One of them is that societies which have less inequality in their wages also have less and not more unemployment. Exact opposite of what everybody says in the neoclassical media. If you look across Europe, for example, where inequality is low up in the north, even though those economies are very open, they have historically had low unemployment. And where it is high, here, Italy, the unemployment rates have historically been much higher. So why is that? Well, surely it's in part because when you have high inequality, that means you have a few good jobs and a lot of bad ones, and people leave the bad jobs to hunt for the good ones. And since there aren't many of them, many people are left unemployed. That's a perfectly reasonable argument, and it turns out to be strongly rooted in empirical reality, not just in Europe, but you can see it in America, you can see it in China, you can see it everywhere in the world. Regulating the level of equality in wages, a historic objective of trade unions, is a way to help assure that unemployment will stay low, not high. Regulating the equality of wages, a historic objective of trade unions, is also a way to assure that productivity growth will continue, and in some cases even accelerate, because it encourages businesses which are highly efficient and discourages ones which are retrograde and reliant on low wages in order to survive. So there's a human strategy, which is part and parcel of a new body of economic ideas. What else? Well, let's say an insurance strategy is an extraordinarily important part of a successful society. This is the welfare state. This is social insurance. What does social insurance do? It protects the most vulnerable people from bad circumstances, from disasters which befall humans, all the unpredictable risks. And when they are protected from that, they can take more risks. They have a better chance of finding the time and the energy to do something with their lives. They're not constantly trying to protect themselves from the possibility of ill health, family problems. Social Security in the United States was not created when we were rich. It was created when we were poor in 1935, in the middle of the Depression. It wasn't a luxury to give workers a steady retirement. It was part of the foundation of what then followed for 70 years, which was stable and steady economic growth and the creation of a strong middle class. Health insurance is another example. Health insurance protects people from the financial consequences of getting sick. That means they don't have to save so much. They can be a little freer with their own resources. It provides a collective security that is impossible to replicate on an individual basis. This is why the attack on the welfare state, which has been part of the neoliberal project, is not only a social disaster, but it's also an economic disaster, something that creates unnecessary economic problems. So an insurance strategy. There needs to be, we'll call it a business and financial strategy, especially a financial strategy, as part of a new economic system. What is a sensible financial strategy? A sensible financial strategy recognizes that the financial system cannot be allowed to control the nation, the economy. It has to be a servant, not a master. It's important to have banks, it's important to have bankers. But it's essential, if the banks and the bankers are to be trusted by the population, that they also have people to whom that they are accountable. That is to say, regulators whom they don't control, who can assure that they are working most of the time in the broader public purpose. Absent that, you get what happened in 2007, 2008 in the United States. The complete collapse following the realization that a vast part of the financial sector had turned to corrupt activity and, in fact, to financial fraud and crime. An environmental strategy has to be part of the way we build the future, have a viable economic system. An environmental strategy is something that was not present in the economics of my childhood, of my youth and professional development. It's a strategy that recognizes that resources are not free, that one has to have a sensible approach to their use and to their conservation. And it's a strategy that has to recognize what we didn't know 40 years ago, or at least didn't know well enough, which is that there are limits, very strict limits, on the amount that we can dispose of into the atmosphere. And if we do not take action to control that and to mitigate and reduce climate change, our children and grandchildren will not forgive us. There has to be a political, a democratic strategy. Why is that? Why do successful economies, the most successful ones, actually have functioning democratic institutions that are not just for show, but that serve their roles effectively? And the answer to that, it seems to me, there are several answers. But one is that democratic institutions engage us in cooperative efforts. They create for us a reason to devote part of our lives part of our energies to a larger project than ourselves. And it is simply false that any economic society can operate on the basis of pure individualism. All societies have to have a mix of the individual and the social, and it's democracy that fosters the social in us. It gives us a common project, legitimates its decision, and protects the rights of discussion and dissent, so that when the society is moving in a risky, dangerous, or ill-fated direction, voices can be heard which will raise objections and begin the process of change. That strikes me as the broad structure of a pluralistic framework for economic thinking going forward. Is it utopian? Is it merely the idle chatter of an armchair philosopher? I don't think so. As I said before, I think it is built on the lived experience of those development projects which were most successful. In the United States from 1900 to 1970, in Europe after the war, certain periods in certain parts of the developing world, especially Latin America. The Progressive Era, the New Deal, the Marshall Plan, the post-war Reconstruction, the work of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, are among the inspirations for what we should be doing now. They recognize that the true foundation of prosperity is not technology. Technology is created frequently, but it can go anywhere. It's not education. There are lots of good education, even in poor countries. It is what it is, and it's not the concrete of highway projects and hydroelectric dams. What it is instead is a system of social purpose achieved by checks and balances, by effective and autonomous and reasonable regulation, which enables us each to play our role in some confidence that others are also playing theirs, and by the dynamic equilibrium, if you like, of private profit and public purpose, the interplay of the individual and the collective, as well as of supply and of demand. The great economists, from Adam Smith, whom I mentioned before, to John Maynard Keynes, understood this very well. In modern times, in my parents' generation, so did an American economist and Russian extraction, Simon Kuznets, Albert Hirschman. In Japan, a man named Chiketo Suro. In Britain, Nicholas Calder. In Argentina, Raul Prebisch. There are names for the traditions that these economists founded: institutionalism, structuralism. These are proper formal names. There's a philosophical tradition called pragmatism. There's a political manifestation called progressivism. All of these things represent the foundations of the ideas that are building around the world now, and sometimes have their political expression in the phrase, "Yes, we can." There's also a word in Spanish that you possibly have never heard, but I heard it at least on one occasion. And to end, if you like, on a fairly light note, I will introduce you to it. I didn't make it up, but I recommend it to you, and that word is galbraithiano. Thank you very much indeed.